Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
I'm Mark Graham. I used to review books for the Rocky Mountain News when there was one. And I recognize some good friends out in the audience. So, and now I review books for tour.com. So if you haven't looked at that online vehicle, take a look. And I reviewed this book a couple weeks ago. Over the many years that I've spent reviewing books, the two most common questions people ask me are these. What's your favorite book? And how do you choose which books you're going to review? First question, really hard to answer because I've read lots of books. And I like lots of books. But I can tell you the book I reread more than any other one, Forrest Gump, approximately 50 times. I used to read it to my English classes on Fridays to keep the students from skipping school. I started doing this several years before the movie came out, and when the Hollywood people cast Tom Hanks, all my students came and said, "What the hell's going on?" Because Forrest Gump's supposed to be 6'6", 245, and he wasn't in the movie, but Forrest still looked pretty good as Tom Hanks. Reading the book worked. I almost never had an absence on Fridays, and so I recommend that to you. Other books that are high on my list are Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, John Steinbeck's Cannery Row, Stephen King's The Stand, Dean Koontz's Watchers, and Christopher Moore's Lamb, The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal. This is all going somewhere. As far as the second question is concerned, it's also difficult to answer. I frequently have received as many as 20 books in a week, and I read one and review it. But I can tell you how I chose the passage and why I'm glad I picked it. I considered the passage in the first place because I received it from a publicist who sent me good books in the past. But what really got me started reading it was the author's name, Cronin. When I played high school football, the assistant coach was a guy named Pat Cronin. He was about 6'8 and weighed about 300 pounds, and he carried around a little baseball bat. And when I screwed up, he'd hit me in the helmet with the baseball bat. I've always blamed my hairstyle on Pat Cronin and the little baseball bat. Now, one of my best friends is a guy named Tim Cronin. You may know him as the color commentator for the Boulder Boulder. I introduced him to his wife, was his best man. They're still married. And he's one of those people that makes you feel good just being around him. So I wondered about this book and this author. Was Justin Cronin going to smack me in the head with a baseball bat with this book, or was reading the novel going to make me feel good? And the answer, as you might have guessed, is both. There's a lot of head smacking that goes on in this book, but there's also a surprising number of feel-good moments. And the passage has a lot in common with the other books I mentioned. Like Forrest Gump, one of the most important characters in the passage is not very bright, but he's misunderstood, mistreated, has a good heart, and hidden strength. Like Huckleberry Finn, the most important part of the passage is a journey with the youngster leading the way. Like Cannery Row, the passage is a serious book in which a group of misfits provides just the right amount of comic relief. Like The Stand and Watchers, the whole thing starts with a government experiment gone awry. And like both of those books, as I started nearing the end of the passage, I read more slowly to make it last. And like Christopher Moore's Lamb, the passage introduces a messiah in ways you would never expect. I like Cronin's books well enough that I searched out his earlier books and bought them, and I can't wait to read them too. I've kept you waiting long enough. Here he is, Justin Cronin.
In an early draft of the passage, the Rocky Mountain News actually is a paper that somebody finds. So God rest the Rocky Mountain News, I guess. You know, time sort of moved on while I was writing the book. There's also a Pontiac in there as well, which is, you know, who knew? Thank you for that great introduction. It's nice to be thought of in such good company as things like Twain. And thank you, Tattered Cover, for having me. This is a bookstore I've always wanted to come to. It's like one of those sort of stations on the cross, you know? There's a few great independents that just everybody's like, did you read a Tattered Cover? You know? And my wife was an independent bookseller for a while, too, at Prairie Lights, a wonderful bookstore in Iowa City. Yeah. And the coolest thing you could do when you lived in Iowa City was date one of the girls at Prairie Lights. That was like, that had like the ultimate sex appeal. So I married one. All right, so the passage, what can I say about the passage? Well, the word that has floated around the Twitter sphere, I can't claim this one for myself, is vampocalypse. I kind of like that. It's a novel of the vampocalypse. I also want to apologize to the state of Colorado for ending the world here. I don't know why. It's a nice state. I really like it. The beautiful scenery and the lovely people, and yet I needed to start the end of the world somewhere, so I did it here. In fact, I've been driving around Denver today looking at some places that are going to figure in the second book. Yeah, there's a whole lot of Denver in the second book. Denver doesn't do so well. Sorry. But it is a novel. Don't take it personal. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I ran into a family that I know at a reading. They had moved away from Houston. I live in Houston now. And they'd moved away from Houston to move to Philadelphia a few years ago where I used to live. So we kept in close touch because I told them where to live and what to do in Philadelphia. And just out of sheer laziness, I had named a family with their family name, right? And then killed them all. And I saw her and I was like, oh, you know, maybe you shouldn't read this. I felt terrible. All right. Okay, so the passage is a novel of before and after. The before, for those of you who do not know the story, is a series of events leading to something known as the Great Viral Catastrophe. The after is a journey taken by Huck Finn and those like him about 100 years later from a small mountain outpost in Southern California to Colorado to save the human race. So Colorado gets to save the human race as well. So well done. In between this before and after, there's a section of the story that I like to read from because it although it sort of stands alone in the book, there's nothing else that's quite like it in the story. It functions as a pivot between these two moments in the book, so you can kind of see a little bit of each of them. And it also has what somebody referred to at a reading as has some of the tender bits, right? I mean, this is a horror novel. It's a post-apocalyptic novel. It's a thriller. It's a coming-of-age story. It's a lot of things. But one of the things I wanted to do is to write a book that had strong, real characters in it. It's not just people acting as luggage handlers for a plot, you know. I learned to write from people like Charles Dickens, and it all depends on who it happens to. So I wanted to read a section that both has that and then also has vampocalypse, right? For those of you who are here for that. So this is chapter 18. I'm dropping you in the middle, but it is a freestanding section. It is a journal. Like the original Dracula, I wanted to have other kinds of documents in the novel. For those of you who know the Bram Stoker, it's got letters and journals in it. And so the passage has journals, emails, newspaper articles, lots of other sort of documents kind of floating through it. And this is a journal written by a woman who is now very old. She lives as an old woman in the second half of the book. She's almost 100 years old. But she was one of the children who was evacuated from the city of Philadelphia in the last days of the war to this mountain outpost where she has lived the remainder of her life, right? And so there's kind of two time frames that are present in this section. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to take a moment to try to figure out how to open my water. Maybe I'll try this one. Cheers. So you're hearing about the past, which is more or less the present that you live in now. You're also hearing a voice of a very old woman living in the future who's lived this very unusual life. But there's also a third time frame present here, and you see it in the heading that introduces this journal. Her name is Ida Jackson, and the heading on it goes like this: From the Journal of Ida Jackson, and then in parentheses, The Book of Auntie. Presented at the third global conference on the North American quarantine period, Center for the Study of Human Cultures and Conflicts, University of New South Wales, Indo-Australian Republic, April 16th, 1003 AV, right? A sort of new dating system. So you're also getting a glimpse at a future 1,000 years from now, right? When this document is being studied, and studied with a certain kind of reverence because it's given the name the Book of Auntie, almost like a gospel. All right. So I'm going to read from this. So you have to imagine, first of all, that I'm a 93-year-old black woman. Okay, so we're all cool with that, right? We can do that. Her voice is a little unusual, has some odd expressions. It has some traces of essentially American urban English, but then some odd phrases that have to do with the fact that she's lived where she has lived all these years in isolation in a small community. And it begins sort of midstream, right, in the middle of a sentence, like it's an artifact. And it was chaos. So many years gone by, but you never forget a sight like that. The thousands of people, all of them so frightened, pressing against the fences, the soldiers and dogs trying to keep folks calm, the shots fired in the air. And me, not more than 8 years old, with my little suitcase, the one my mama had packed for me the night before, bawling the whole time because she knew what she was doing, that she was sending me away forever. The jumps had taken New York, Pittsburgh, D.C., most of the whole country, as far as I recall. I had folks in all those places. There was lots we didn't know, such as what had happened to Europe or France or China, though I'd heard my daddy talking to some other men from our street about how the virus was different there. It just flat out killed everyone, so I'm supposing it was possible that Philadelphia was the last city left with people in the whole wide world at that time. We were an island. When I asked my mama about the war, she explained that the jumps were people like you and me, just sick. I'd been sick myself, so it scared me about out of my skin when she told me this. I just started crying my eyes out, thinking I would wake up one day and kill her and my daddy and my cousins the way the jumps like to do. She hugged me hard and told me, "No, no, Ida, it's different. That's not the same kind of a thing at all. You hush now and stop your crying," which I did. But even so, for a while, it didn't make no sense to me why there was a war on and there were soldiers everywhere if folks had just come down with a sniffle or something in their throat. That's what we called them, jumps. Not vampires, though you heard the word said. That's what my cousin Terrence said they were. He showed me in a comic that he had, which was a kind of picture book, as I recall. But when I asked my daddy about that and showed him the pictures, he told me no, vampires were just something in a made-up story. Nice-looking men in suits and capes with good manners. And this here's real, Ida. Ain't no story about it. There's lots of names for them now, of course. Flyers and smokes and drinks and virals and such. But we called them jumps on account of that's what they did when they got you. They jumped. My daddy said, no matter what you call them, they are some mean sons of bitches. You stay inside like the army says, Ida. It shocked me to hear him speaking such, because my daddy was a deacon of the AME, and I'd never heard him talk that way, use words of the kind. Nights was the worst of it, especially that winter. We didn't have the lights like we do now. There weren't much food except what the army gave us, no heat except what you could find to burn. The sun went down and you could feel it, that fear snapping down like a lid on everything. We didn't know if that would be the night the jumps got in. My daddy had boarded up the windows of our house and he kept a gun, too, kept it with him all night as he sat at the kitchen table by candlelight, listening to the radio, maybe sipping a bit. He'd been a communications officer in the Navy and knew about such things. One night I came in and found him crying there, just sitting with his face in his hands and shaking and weeping, the tears all running down his cheeks. Don't know what it was that woke me, except maybe the sound of him. He was a strong man, my daddy, and it shamed me to see him in such a state as that. I said, Daddy, what is it? Why are you crying like you are? Did something scare you? And he shook his head and said, God don't love us no more, Ida. Maybe it was something we did, but he don't. He's up and flown the coop on us. Then my mama came in and told him to hush up, Monroe, you're drunk, and shooed me back to bed. That was my daddy's name, Monroe Jackson III. My mama was Anita. At the time, I didn't know it, but I think maybe the night he was crying was when he heard about the train. Only the good Lord knows why he spared Philadelphia long as he did. I barely remember it now, except the feeling of it, time to time. Little things, like stepping out with my daddy at night to get a water ice up the corner, and my friends at school, Joseph Pennell Elementary, and a little girl named Cherise, who lived down the corner from us. The two of us could just keep each other going for hours and hours. I looked for her on the train, but I never did find her. I remember my address, 2121 West Levere. There was a college near there, and stores, and busy streets, and all sorts of people going to and fro in the day-to-day. And I remember a time when my daddy took me downtown, out of our neighborhood, on the bus to see the windows at Christmas time. I couldn't have been much more than 5 years old. The bus carried us past the hospital where my daddy worked, taking x-rays, which were photographic pictures of people's bones. He'd had that job since he'd gotten out of the service and met my mama, and he always said it was the perfect job for a man like him, how he got to look at the insides of things. He'd wanted to be a doctor, but taking the x-rays, he said, was the next best thing. Outside the store, he showed me the windows, all done up fancy for Christmas, with lights and snow and a tree, and moving figures inside them, elves and reindeer and such. I'd never been happy like that in all my life, just to see so beautiful a sight, standing in the cold like we were, the two of us together. We were going to pick up a present for Mama, he told me, his big hand on my head like he did, a scarf or maybe gloves. The streets were all full of people, so many people, all different ages and looks to them. I like to think about it even now, to send my mind back to that day. No one remembers Christmas anymore, but it was a bit like first night is now. I don't recall if we got the scarf and gloves or not. Probably we did. That's all gone now, all of it. And stars. Time to time, I think that's what I miss seeing most of all, back in the time before. From the window of my bedroom, I could look over the roofs of the buildings and the houses and see them, these points of light in the sky, hanging there like God his own self had strung the sky for Christmas. It was my mama who told me the names for some and how you could watch them a while and start to see pictures up there, simple things like spoons and people and animals. I used to think you could look at the stars, and that was God, right there, like looking straight into his face. You needed the dark to see him plain. Maybe he forgot us, and maybe he didn't. Maybe it was us who forgot when we couldn't see the stars anymore. And to tell the truth, they're the one thing I'd like to see again before I die. There were other trains, I do believe. We'd heard about trains leaving from all over that other cities had sent them before the jumps got in. Maybe it was just people talking like they do when they're scared, grasping at any bit of hope that floats on past. I don't know how many made it all the way to where they were going. Some were sent to California, some to places with names I don't just now recall. There was only one we ever heard from back in the early days, before the walkers and the one law when radio was still allowed. Someplace in New Mexico, I do believe it was. But something happened to their lights, and we didn't hear from them again after that. And from what Peter and Theo and the others tell me, I do believe we are the only ones left now. But the train in Philadelphia and what all happened that winter was what I meant to write on. Folks was in the worst way. The army was everywhere, not just soldiers, but tanks and other things of the kind. My daddy said they were there to protect us from the jumps, but to me they were just big men with guns, most of them white. And my daddy had always told me to look on the bright side, Ida, but not to trust the white man. That's how he said it, like they was all one man. Though, of course, that seems funny now, folks all blended together like they are. Probably whoever is reading this doesn't even know what I'm talking about. We knew a fellow from up the way got himself shot just for trying to catch a dog. I suppose he thought eating a dog was better than nothing. But the army shot him and strung him up on a light post on Olney Avenue with a sign pinned to his chest that said, "Looter." Don't know what he was trying to loot, except maybe a dog that was half-starved and going to die anyway. Then one night we heard the loudest boom, and then another and another, and planes screaming over our heads. And my daddy told me they'd blown the bridges, and all the next day we saw more planes and smelled fire and smoke, and we knew the jumps was close. I went to bed and woke up later to the sounds of a set to. Our place was just four rooms, and voices had a way of carrying. You couldn't sneeze in one room without somebody in another saying, "Bless you." And I heard my mama crying and crying, and my father saying to her, "You can't. We have to. You be strong, Anita," things of that kind. And then the door to my room swung open and I saw my daddy standing there. He was holding a candle, and I'd never in my life seen him with such a look upon his face, like he'd seen a ghost, and the ghost was his own self. He dressed me quick for the cold and said, "Be good now, Ida, and go say goodbye to your mother." And when I did, she held me a long, long time, crying so hard it makes me hurt to think of it, even now, all these years gone by. I saw the little suitcase by the door, and I said, "Are we going somewhere, Mama? We leaving?" But she didn't answer me. She just went on crying and holding me like she did until my daddy made her let go. Then we left, my daddy and me, just the two of us. It wasn't until we were outside and I realized it was still the middle of the night. It was cold and blowing. Flakes were falling and I thought it was snow, but when I licked one off my hand, I realized it was ashes. You could smell the smoke and it was stinging my eyes and throat. We had to walk a long way most of the night. The only things moving on the streets were the army trucks, some of them with horns on top and voices coming out of them telling people not to steal, stay calm about the evacuation. There were some folks about, but not many, though we saw more and more the farther we went until the streets were thick with people, no one saying a word, all walking the same direction as us, carrying their things. I don't think I'd even figured it out in my mind that it was just the littles who were going. It was still dark when we got to the station. I've already said a thing or two about that. My father told me we got there early so as to avoid the lines. He always hated lines, but it was like half the city had the same idea. We waited a long time, but things were turning ugly, like a storm was coming, the air whizzing and cracking with it. Folks was too afraid. The fires were going out. The jumps were coming. That's what people were saying. We could hear great booms in the distance, like thunder and planes flying overhead, fast and low. And each time you saw one, your ears would pop and you'd hear a boom a second after and the ground would shake beneath your feet. Some folks had littles with them, but not all. My father held my hand tight. There was an opening in the fence where the soldiers were letting people in, and that's what we had to get through. It was so tight with the people pressed together, I could hardly take a breath. "Whatever happens, you hold on to me, Ida," my daddy said. "Just hold on." We got close enough that we could see the train down below us. We were on a bridge, the rails running under it. I tried to follow its length with my eyes, but I couldn't. That's how long it was. It seemed to stretch forever, 100 cars. It didn't look like any train I'd ever seen. The cars didn't have any windows, and long poles stuck out from the sides with nets hanging from them like the wings of a bird. On the roof, there were soldiers with big guns in metal cages, like something you'd put a canary in. At least I supposed they were soldiers on account of they were wearing shiny silver suits to protect them from the fires. I don't remember what happened to my father. Certain things you can't remember because your mind won't take them up once they're done and gone. I remember a woman who had a cat in a box and a soldier saying, "Lady, what do you think you're doing with that cat?" And then something happened quick, and believe it or not, that soldier shot her right there. And then there was more shooting and folks tearing about and pushing and screaming, and my daddy and me got separated in all of it. When I reached for my daddy, his hand wasn't there anymore. The crowd was moving like a river, dragging me along. It was a horrible thing. People was yelling that the train wasn't full, but it was leaving anyway. If you can imagine, I'd lost my suitcase, and that's what I was thinking of. I've lost my suitcase, and my daddy's going to be hopping mad at me for that. He was always saying, "Look after your things, Ida. Don't be careless. We work hard to have the things we do, so don't go treating them like nothing." So I had just about figured I was in the worst trouble of my life, all on account of the suitcase, when something knocked me to the ground, and when I got up, I saw all the dead folks around me. And one was a boy I thought I knew from school. Vincent Gum. That's what we always called him. Vincent Gum. Both names together. And wouldn't you know, that boy was always getting in trouble on account of he liked to chew gum and always had a piece in his mouth at school. But now he had a hole in him right in the center of his chest, and he was lying on his back on the ground in a puddle of blood. There was more blood coming out of the hole in his chest in little bubbles, like soap in a bath. I remember thinking, that's Vincent Gum, lying dead right there. A bullet went through his body and killed him. He's never going to move or talk or chew his gum or do nothing at all, and he'll be right there in that spot forever with that forgetful look on his face. I was still on the bridge over the train, and folks were starting to leap down to it. A lot of the soldiers were shooting at them, like somebody had told them to shoot anything, no matter what it was. I looked over the edge and saw the bodies piling up there like logs on a fire, and blood everywhere, so much blood, you'd think the world had sprung a leak. Somebody picked me up then. I thought it was my daddy. He'd come to find me after all, but it wasn't. It was just a man. A big, fat white man with a beard. He snatched me up by the waist and ran to the other side of the bridge, where there was a kind of pathway down through some weeds. We were at the top of a wall above the tracks, and the man held me by the hands and lowered me down, and I thought, he's going to drop me and I'm going to die like Vincent Gum did. I was looking right at that man, and I'll never forget his eyes. They were the eyes of a person who knew he was as good as dead. When you have that look, you're not young or old or black or white or even a man or a woman. You're gone from all those things. He was yelling, "Somebody take her! Somebody take this girl here!" And then somebody grabbed my legs from below and lifted me down, and the next thing I knew, I was on the train, and it was moving. And somewhere in there, I came to think I'd never be seeing any of them again, not my mama or daddy or anybody I had known in my life to that day. What I remember after that is more like a feeling than any actual thing. I remember children crying and being hungry and the dark and heat and smell of bodies all crammed in. We could hear gunfire outside and feel the heat from the fires passing through the walls of the train like the whole world was aflame. Some of the children weren't no more than 4 years old, practically babies. We had two watchers in the car with us, a man and a woman. I don't remember what became of that woman, but that man was first family, a chow. He married another watcher, and after she died, he had two other wives. One of those wives was Maisie Chow, old Chow's grandmother. But the thing was, the train didn't stop. Not for anything. Time to time, we'd hear a great big boom, and the car would shake like a leaf in the wind, but still we kept right on. One day, the woman left the car and went back to help with some of the other children and came back all crying. I heard her tell the man that the other cars behind us were gone. They'd built the train so that if the jumps got into a car, they could leave it behind, and those were the booms we'd heard, one car after another falling away. I didn't want to think about those cars and the children inside them, and to this day, I don't. So I'm not going to write anything more about that here. What you'll want to know about is when we got here, and I do remember some of that, because that was how I found Terrence, my cousin. I didn't know he was on the train with me, and it was a lucky thing he hadn't been one of the cars at the back, because by the time we arrived, there weren't more than three, and two of them mostly empty. We were in California, the watchers told us. California wasn't like a state like it used to be, they said. It was a whole different country. Buses would be meeting us to take us up a mountain, someplace safe. The train slowed to a stop, and everyone was afraid, but excited, too, to be getting off the train after all the days and days. And then the door opened, and the light was so bright, we all held our hands over our faces. Some of the children were crying because they thought it was the jumps. The jumps were coming to get us, and somebody else said, "Don't be stupid, it ain't the jumps." And when I opened my eyes, I was relieved to see a soldier standing there. We were in the desert. They took us off, and there was lots more soldiers around, and a line of buses parked in the sand, and helicopters flocking overhead, stirring up the dust all around and making every kind of a racket. They gave us water to drink, cold water. All my days, I've never been so glad just to taste cold water. The light was so bright to my eyes, it still hurt me even to look around, but that's when I saw Terrence. He was standing there in the dust like the rest of us, holding a suitcase and a dirty pillow. I'd never hugged a boy so hard or so long in my life, and we were both laughing and crying and saying, "Look at you." We weren't first cousins, but more like second, as I recall. His father was my daddy's nephew, Carlton Jackson. Carlton was a welder at the shipyard, and Terrence later told me his daddy was one of the men who built the train. A day before the evacuation, Uncle Carlton had taken Terrence to the station and put him in the engine car closest to driver and told him to stay there. "You stay put, Terrence. Do what driver tells you." So that was how Terrence had come to be with me now. He was 3 years older than me, but it seemed like more at the time, so I said to him, "You'll look after me, won't you, Terrence? Say you'll do that." And he nodded and said, yes, he would. And that was just what he did until the day he died. They loaded us onto the buses. Everything felt different to me with Terrence there. He lent me his pillow to use, and I fell asleep with my head leaned against him. So I couldn't say how long we were in the buses, though I don't think it was more than a day. Then before I knew it, Terrence was saying, "Wake up, Ida. We're here. Wake up now." And right away I could smell how different the air was. More soldiers took us off, and for the first time I saw the walls and the lights above us standing high on their poles. The air was fresh and bright and so cold that all of us were stamping our feet and shivering. There was army everywhere and FEMA trucks of all sizes full of every kind of thing, food and guns and toilet paper and clothes, and some with animals in them, sheep and goats and horses and chickens in cages, even some dogs. The watchers put us all in lines like they'd done before and took our names and gave us clean clothes and took us to the sanctuary. The room they put us in was the one most everyone knows where all the littles sleep to this very day. I took a cot next to Terrence and asked him the question that was on my mind, which was, "What is this place, Terrence? Your daddy must have told you if he built the train." And Terrence was very still for a moment and said, "This is where we live from now on. The lights and walls will keep us safe, safe from the jumps, safe from everything until the war is over. It's like the story of Noah, and this here's the ark." I asked him, "What ark, and what are you talking about, and will I ever see my mama and daddy again?" And he said, "I don't know, Ida, but I'll look after you, like I said." Sitting on the bed on the other side was a girl no older than me who was just crying and crying, and Terrence went to her and said quietly, "What's your name?" And, "I'll look after you too if you want," which made her stop. She was a beauty, that one. You could see it plain as day, even as dirty and worn down as all of us were. The sweetest little face and hair so light and wispy, it was like a baby's the way they do. She nodded and answered, "Yes, would you please do that? And if it's not too much trouble, can you look after my brother too?" And wouldn't you know, that girl, Lucy Fisher, became my very best friend and was the one that Terrence married later on. Nobody said it was my job to remember all these things, but it seems to me that without me to put them down, they'd all be gone by now. Not just how we came to be here, but that world, the old world of the time before. Buying gloves and a scarf at Christmas, and walking with my daddy up the block for water ice, and sitting in a window on a summer night to watch the stars come on. They're all dead now, of course, the first ones. Most have been dead so long, or else taken up, that no one even remembers their names anymore. When I think back on those days, it's not sadness I feel. A little sadness for missing folks like Terrence, who was taken up at 27, and Lucy, who died in childbirth not long after, and Maisie Chow, who did live a good while, but passed in a manner I don't just now recall. The hardest to think on are the ones who let it go the way so many did over the years. The ones who took it into their own hands from sadness or worry or just not wanting to carry the weight of this life no more. they're the ones I dream on. Like they left the world unfinished and don't even know they've gone. But I suppose it's part of being old to feel that way, half in one world and half in the other, all of it mixed together in my mind. No one's left who even knows my name. Folks call me Auntie on account of I never could have children of my own, and I guess that suits me fine. Sometimes it's like I've got so many people inside me, I'm never alone at all. And when I go, I'll be taking them with me. The Watchers told us the army would be coming back, bringing more children and soldiers, but they never did. The buses and trucks pulled away, and as darkness settled down, they sealed the gates, and then the lights came on, bright as day, so bright they blotted out the stars. It was a sight to see. Terrence and I had gone outside to look, the two of us shivering in the cold, and I knew then that what he'd said was so. This was where we would live from now on. We were there together on first night when the lights came on and the stars went out. And in all those years since then, the years and years and years, I never have seen those stars again, not once. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.